convene, begin, gather this panel. This is the My Creed, What Do I Believe, What Do I Value section. And I'm Bonnie Bobet. I'm moderating the panel. And I'm going to say, first of all, that we are appearing according to numbers that we drew by lottery or by lot. Because part of my creed is that there is an inevitable randomness to this life. So first up will be Elizabeth Sandberg. Second will be me. Third will be Ben McClinton. Fourth will be Mark Muir. I've gotten my numbers screwed up. First is Elizabeth Sandberg. Second is Dick Paul Freeman. Sorry, Dick. Third is Ben McClinton. Fourth is Mark Muir. Fifth is me, and sixth is Nadine Hansen. I want to be very brief in both introducing the concept of the panel and in introducing the members of the panel. First of all, in terms of what we're doing as panelists, this section is really a takeoff on what I felt was one of the best Sunstone Symposium panels I've ever been to. Last August, Scott Kenny put together a panel of people writing and reading their creed statements, and I liked it so much that I thought it would be very nice in the Bay Area for us to have a chance to do something like that here, too. There were no requirements or constraints other than that our statements be A, written, and B, 7 minutes or under, except mine was clocked this morning and it was 8 minutes, but somebody else doled me over one of their minutes. So really, time was the only constraint or requirement. I suspect that there is going to be a great diversity, not only in what we have to say, but also in how we say it. These statements may vary from the laundry list creed statement format to the highly experiential. There also was no attempt on my part to seek for any kind of particular diversity or seek for a variety of Mormon perspectives. We all either are or were members of the church, and certainly our Mormonism informs what we have written and what we will say. There is no designated liberal, there's no designated orthodox, there's no designated conservative. A woman who was unable to appear on the panel because of a conflict is a woman who's active in my ward, asked me if she was the designated conservative. And I told her no, even though she would have been, I suspect, on the panel. But I told her no, and told her that what I was more interested in, because of where I am at this stage in my life, is perhaps the diversity within each of us than the diversity among us. So that might just be something for you to think about after we each deliver our 7 minute or less sermonettes, and there's time for questions. Just so I don't have to keep interrupting the flow and getting up and down, I'm going to introduce everyone right now in order of the lot that we drew. First will be Elizabeth Sandberg, who was both born and raised in Switzerland and born and raised in the church there. She graduated in Switzerland with a degree in education. She went on to study music at BYU and graduated with a BA in music. She has been married for 11 years. She has three children, three sons. She and her husband have three sons. Betts tells me that she is suffering from testosterone poisoning in her family. their twin boys are the apples of my six-year-old daughter's eye, however. So she is on the homemaking board of the Berkeley Ward Relief Society, and she's a visiting teacher. Second will be Dick Paul Freeman. Dick is... yeah, I have to be careful what I say. He's my home teacher. I was about to say of the men on the panel, he is currently probably the most highly churched, or not probably, he is the most highly churched. He is High Priest Group Leader in the Oakland First Ward. He's been a bishop. He was my bishop at a important time in my life. He has been in the stake presidency. He is a wonderful home teacher. He's my home teacher. He's a businessman. He has a bachelor of degree, a BA, I believe in economics, I think it was, from the University of Utah, and an MBA from the U as well. He's married to Lindy Paul Freeman, who's also, I saw her in the back row, right over there. They have five children. Dick is an avid reader. He's a student of theology, history, philosophy, and he's an, as he puts it, an amateur, but I would say also a very entertaining pianist. So Dick will be second. Ben McClinton will be third, and Ben really kind of delivered for me a very terse statement of his background, or succinct, I guess is a better word. Ben wanted me to say that he loves his wife, who is Karen Rosenbaum, who's sitting right here, and that he likes to walk and read. He is an attorney in court administration. Also, as part of his background, he lived abroad for about 8 years, and that has been an informing experience in his life. Number four is Mark Muir, Mark Parmley Muir, whom I have known for many, many years, and we both lie about our ages, so we won't say how many. Mark has a Bachelor of Arts from Cal at Berkeley in geology and a master's from the University of Washington in geology. He is an environmental management consultant. Mark left the church after the excommunications of September 1993, but prior to that time, he has held just about every kind of church position on the ward, stake, and regional level, including elders quorum president, a counselor, and twice, and a counselor in two bishoprics. At one point, four offers from four different wards were tendered to him at the same time to teach the gospel doctrine class, and he is a wonderful teacher. Number five is me. I'm Bonnie Beaubay, and I get to be brief about my life. I live in Albany. I have a six-year-old daughter, and I have been enjoying a long, extended sabbatical from my life as an advertising agency copywriter, creative director, and I'll have to face reality again at some point. Number six is going to be Nadine Hansen. And Nadine is an attorney in private practice in Cupertino. She received her law degree from the University of Santa Clara. Her undergraduate degree was from San Jose State, also in economics with a minor in religious studies. Nadine has been married for a very long time and has four grown and almost grown children. So with that, I'm going to get out of the picture and let the panel just kind of go in rotation, beginning with Betts first.
Thank you, Bonnie. For many years, I have tried to come to grips with my belief system. Quite unconsciously at first, I started to sort religious, spiritual, and doctrinal ideas in two categories: the things that I believed in and the things that I didn't believe in. The latter category grew very quickly, especially while sitting in church, listening to talks and lessons. It got to the point where in the car on the way home, I would turn to Mark, my husband, and say, "Why don't we even bother to come to church anymore?" Nothing has been said that I believe in, and my comments didn't seem to be that well received either. And maybe we should just create our own religious family worship on Sundays. I soon realized that if we did that, I would have to sit down and look exactly at what I believe in, and look exactly at what I didn't believe in. That's when I recognized my second list was still practically non-existent, and that was maybe part of the reason why I feel so often so terribly out of place in church. A friend of mine, quite a few years back, went through a shake-up when she realized that maybe the Book of Mormon wasn't the historical record that she was brought up to believe that it was. She went to the bishop and expressed her feelings, and after listening for a while, the bishop said, "Do you believe in the New Testament?" And she said, "Yeah, I believe in the New Testament, especially in Jesus Christ." He then replied, "Go home, read the New Testament, and leave the Book of Mormon alone. Concentrate on what lifts your spirits, then it will be easier to deal with the rest." Here are my two most important beliefs that lift my spirit. First of all, I believe in Jesus Christ and in his mission. He came to the sinners, to the downcast, and the sick. He brought them comfort and healing. I was talking to a friend and telling her about that, and she said, "Well, I don't even know if I believe that he was literally the Son of God. But I don't think that that even matters. He brought a complete new worldview into life, and I think that's what I'm looking at. He showed genuine respect and love to the women he encountered, and he treated them no different than the men. He showed little patience for the Pharisees, who were preoccupied with the letter of the law rather than the Spirit. This gives me hope for my life and my salvation. I have prayed. I have fasted. I have read the scriptures. I have even gone to the temple. And I have found comfort in all of it. The answers I found didn't and don't always coincide with the official church teachings. But they were and are always true to my feelings and true to my conscience. I think that's all that's expected of me, to be honest to be true to myself. My second belief that raises my spirit is Christ's message to us. Love thy neighbor as thyself. I was brought up in a Mormon community. That's where I found my neighbors. I was loved by them, and through service, loved them back. Neighbors don't always share the same opinion. In fact, the only thing they often have in common is the neighborhood. I know my church neighborhood. I more or less feel comfortable in it because I'm familiar with it. And so for right now, I stay in it. I enjoy serving that neighborhood. I feel comfortable raising my kids in it. And in it, I have found lots of wonderful friends. In it, I have also found people with whom I have absolutely nothing in common and whom I do not understand, whose lessons and talks make no sense to me. But these people belong to my neighborhood, and I will try to accept and to love them. Neighborhoods, however, change, and the day might come when I decide that I need to find an environment where it is easier to serve and love my neighbors, and that a new neighborhood is essential for the growth of my soul. The greatest challenge in this life is to learn to live with paradoxes. My paradox is that the neighborhood with my most intimate friends also houses my most intimate strangers. Right now, for some weird reason that I'm not always sure I know, I still feel that there is a place for me in the Mormon neighborhood. And it is a good place as long as I can concentrate on its essence, Christ's mission and message. Thank you.
Perhaps a good place to begin is to state my creed regarding creeds. I believe that a creed should be a statement of those beliefs and values that motivate an individual's life. The intended emphasis in this definition lies with the implementation of the set of beliefs and values into a life, beliefs and values that give direction and purpose to the down and dirty business of everyday living. By contrast, the word creed is not meant to signify beliefs or values that have been acknowledged, but rarely, if ever, translated into everyday living. I believe that a creed must be dynamic, constantly changing in response to accumulating experience, changing perspectives, study, thought, and contact with the divine. Thus, I believe that a critical feature of our life should be an ongoing search for truth, and a constant effort to incorporate it into our character. I believe that implicit in such a process is a requirement to learn to live with unresolved questions, some of which may ultimately be answered in this life, and many of which will not, but will be more susceptible to understanding in the next life because of the searching and the struggling that went on here. In many cases, I believe that the process of actively wrestling with life's unresolved questions is at least as valuable as producing a satisfactory answer. As I have grown older, life has become grayer, and I'm not necessarily referring only to my hair color. In my younger days, life seemed so much simpler, so much more black and white. However, longevity has seemingly blurred what previously seemed so clearly defined, requiring a greater openness and a hesitancy to judge. In fact, particularly in religious affairs, I become very suspicious of certitude. Too often it has stopped the search for truth, generated intolerance, and created self-righteousness on the part of individuals and institutions alike. Right and wrong can be relative and situational, and discerning one from the other, if possible, can require much more than adherence to simple dogma. Apart from a few basics, life will largely involve seeing through a glass darkly, as Paul said, and it is the effort and struggle to see more clearly and to incorporate the truths learned into our characters that constitutes the real business of living. I believe in a loving, personal God and in His Son, Jesus Christ. I believe that they love and care for me individually and for all mankind collectively. I believe that they are no respecter of persons, not on account of sex, race, nationality, wealth, or any of the other distinctions that we humans so readily use as a means to demean and exploit. I believe that they are all good, but not necessarily all powerful, and that they are frequently limited by our acts, the acts of other co-eternal entities. I truly believe that men are that they might have joy, as the Book of Mormon indicates, and that as we learn of and follow God, we can find joy and fulfillment in this existence, despite the natural and moral evils that afflict this world. I believe that God does intervene from time to time in the affairs of men, but much less than is generally supposed. I should say, parenthetically, that Bonnie and I think shared a very special experience where that was the case. I don't particularly believe in a devil. There's enough evil in the world by virtue of the makeup of the physical world in which we live and man's inhumanity to man to make such a being redundant. And I don't believe that God uses evil either to punish or to test us. I believe that there are many paths to God, and I respect all, regardless of specific belief, who demonstrate their love of God by service to their fellow men. I believe that with few exceptions, all of us are innately good, reflecting divine parenthood, and those that aren't, weren't always so. I believe that God is not as judgmental as he is commonly pictured, and that he is more interested in if and what we learn from mistakes, and if we continue to struggle to do what is right, than in the sins themselves. I believe that we will largely judge ourselves, but from a God-supplied perspective, and that judgment will be based on what we have become, not what we know or what we have done. Further, I believe that whatever judgment there is will be used primarily to place us in the right position for future development and experience. I believe that none of the foregoing matters if it's not translated into a love of and service to our fellow beings. In such a perspective, service to our fellow should be but a natural outgrowth of our love of God, and in turn a love of all of our fellow mortals. I believe the institutional church has an important role to play here, to teach basic gospel truths and to provide the ordinances or covenants that are meant to provide direction to our lives. Further, it is within the church that we should receive support, encouragement, and love from fellow believers, and it is also there that we have an at least equal responsibility to provide the same assistance to others. Thus, our church responsibility includes both giving and receiving. There are dangers in church experience, including a selfish obsession with perfection and a focus on the ritualistic and worshiping aspects of religion while neglecting the social and service requirements of a truly religious life. I firmly believe in Christ's admonition that he who would be chief among you should be the servant of all, and that those charged with church administration must discharge their duties with that as their primary motive if the church is to accomplish its mission. I truly believe that righteousness is happiness, and that there is a direct correlation between joy, happiness, peace, and contentment in my own life and my personal righteousness. I believe that we must love all, avoid judging, serve others to the extent of our capabilities, and to strive to live in accordance with the dictates of the Holy Ghost. I believe that if we will but lose ourselves in the service of others, and by this I don't just mean in the service of other Mormons, that we can experience joy in this life despite its vicissitudes and inherent sorrows and suffering. Or as Emerson said, the great masses of men worry themselves into endless graves, while here and there a few great souls forget themselves into everlasting immortality. Ultimately, all we can take from this sphere is ourselves, and a large part of ourselves will be the product of our relationships with others. We must be careful not to just let life happen. We must think about it. We must pray about it. We must work it. We must persevere and love it. As Arthur Bassett pointed out a number of years ago in his Sunstone Symposium, the work of this life is not in knowing or even doing. Rather, it is in becoming a truly righteous soul. Thank you.
Although the word creed may come from the Latin credo, which means simply, I believe, creed has come to mean an authoritative and formulated statement usually adopted by a religious group rather than an individual as we are doing here. And as such, it probably has an element of coercion. It certainly has an element of coercion when it's adopted by a religious group. When I started to write my personal creed, I tried to set down in similar formulaic fashion. It didn't work. Every word had too much weight. Every phrase became too significant. It is paralyzing to try to make a statement about one's core that must be absolute, true, always. So instead, over a few weeks, I jotted down thoughts based on real situations in my life and situations in my community at large, as you will see. Here they are in mostly random order. And I do, by the way, expect that the list will keep growing after today. I believe the essence of Christianity or any religion or other form of deliberate living is a love of humankind. I believe in the gospel that is the good word that we really can live together, loving and serving each other, if we just make the effort. I believe all religions to be the word of God, insofar as they are translated correctly. I believe that living is learning and doing, so that one does not become a dim bulb in the marquee of life. I believe my government should not kill people, and if it does, I should express my disagreement. I believe it is a mistake to act as if property and money are the same thing as vivid life. I believe that my life is enriched immeasurably by preserving the wild things, fish, flesh, and fowl, and the wild places where they live, preserving those creatures and places we may visit but not control. I believe that God is the expression of our awe of all creation and of the miracle of our consciousness of our own existence. Deep breath. I believe that cutting mothers and children off the dole while keeping corporations, mining companies, ranchers, agribusiness, and the military on the dole is not my idea of getting the government off the backs of the people. Nor is putting prayer into the schools, invading the bedroom or gynecologist office, or warehousing children in orphanages, nor is building more prisons while trashing social programs or eliminating regulations that protect our health, our job safety, our air, our water, or our wilderness. Enough of political screed. I believe Christianity is an ideal, but it is impossible because it makes greater demands than the nature of man can bear. I believe that our national security is better protected by having an educated, healthy population than having military hardware or might. I believe in thrift, miserliness, some who know me might say. I believe that, which means reducing my material wants so that I live the saying, waste not, want not, but more precisely, want not, want not. I believe in raising the minimum wage and lowering the maximum wage. I believe William James when he says, be not afraid of life. Believe that life is worth living, and your belief will help create that fact. I believe that abortion is not right, but I believe as emphatically that every woman should have the right to a legal and safe one if that's what she thinks is necessary. I believe in the importance of the senses, so much so that no heaven would be without the smell of cut grass, the taste of homemade vanilla ice cream, the sound of Mahler's music, the touch of warm, smooth skin, the sight of a Japanese garden in the rain. I believe in passion, anger, joy, love, fear, and the overwhelming, sweet, sick yearning for another person. I believe what Ecclesiastes says, a man hath no better thing under the sun than to eat and to drink and to be merry. And also, as Ecclesiastes says, all is vanity. I believe in guilt, the kind we take in with our mother's milk, and that it is guilt that makes the world go round. Two thoughts in conclusion. I believe, along with Havelock Ellis, that a man must not swallow more beliefs than he can digest. That may help you get through this session. And to conclude, an injunction to myself and any of you developing a personal creed, I believe in Ralph Waldo Emerson's imperative, go put your creed into your deed.
On Thursday, March 8th, 1973, I won the draft lottery. When I say I won the draft lottery, I don't mean that I got such a high number that there was no credible chance of my being drafted. Rather, I got number one, the highest draft priority. Another way to say that is that if President Nixon had just wanted somebody extra to pick up cigarette butts at Fort Ord, it probably would have been me. It's about the only contest I ever won in my life. And when, as an aside, when Bonnie said, "Let's have a lottery as to which order we go," I had this internal cringing. What followed was a period of extreme anguish, which culminated in my decision to become a conscientious objector. I was one of the few Mormon conscientious objectors out of the Vietnam era. Now, I was not the type of conscientious objector who did alternate service. I was the type who would enter the military but not carry a gun. This was not a happy decision, because what they did with that type of CO was they made them medics. And when they went to Vietnam, they had a much higher mortality rate than the normal draftee, because very few draftees ever really saw service at the front lines. Most of them were in support positions, but medics went to the front lines. It was not a happy decision, but it was the single finest moral decision I ever made. One of the things that made it so difficult was to have this decision that to me was so clearly inspired, and yet to realize that I was so completely out of step with a great majority of the people who shared my faith. I pondered a long time trying to figure out how this could be so. And out of that grew two elements of my creed. First, for certain moral issues, there are mutually exclusive forms of righteousness that, though they appear contradictory to us, all are acceptable to God, and all are necessary. Secondly, for the health and progress of the church, on those same moral issues on which we have to have mutually exclusive forms of righteousness, we must have a diversity that ranges the full range of possible moral approaches. And I find that those elements of my creed are sufficiently different than most Mormons that it requires a little explanation. I'll spend the rest of my time doing that. And I will use as my guide the story of the people of Ammon and Captain Moroni from the Book of Alma in the Book of Mormon. They were my guide 22 years ago, and they'll serve today. Just a refresher for those of you who are not familiar with those passages. There was a brutal war at that time. And the people of Ammon were a group that had renounced war. And they kept that oath even at the point of death, and many of them were killed. Captain Moroni was a military leader who essentially ended up in control of the country, and he fought for liberty and truth and to free the oppressed. Now, one thing that I've always loved about that, and I think we need to point it out, is those groups supported each other, even when national and individual survival was at stake. When the people of Ammon were wavering in their oath to renounce war, Helaman, an associate of Captain Moroni's, talked them out of it. And throughout the war, the people of Ammon supported Captain Moroni's armies with food and other supplies. And when their sons were old enough, their sons volunteered for Captain Moroni's armies with their parents' blessing. That's particularly meaningful to me, that support that was given, because after I became a conscientious objector, after I'd made the decision to try, my father, a World War II veteran, sat me down and said, "Mark, I completely disagree with the decision you've made, but I will do my best to support you to argue your position before the draft board." And he did. He went out, ransacked bookstores in San Francisco and found all sorts of stuff that I never would have found. So, keeping that in mind, let's take a look at the example of the people of Ammon and Captain Moroni and see what's instructive in that for us. The first is that both groups are explicitly described as being highly righteous. There is nothing from the available account to say that one group is better than the other or more nearly conformed to God's expectations. The second, this is not church architecture that we're speaking about. This was the response to war is as fundamental a moral issue as we face as humans. As we have the extraordinary instance of two groups of people, both highly righteous, same problem, same time, and yet a highly divergent response to that problem. Third, as I've mentioned, despite their difficulties or their differences, despite the absolute difficulties of the war they waged, they supported each other. Based on my experience as a Mormon conscientious objector and many observations since, such unqualified support for a diverse viewpoint is very rare in the modern church. There are places such as Sunstone Symposia and some wards and stakes where tolerance is quite evident. But unqualified, unreserved respect and support for a diverse viewpoint, very rare. And fourthly, finally, it's critical to note that the decisions that the people of Ammon and Captain Moroni made were mutually exclusive. Another way to say this is, you cannot be both a conscientious objector and a militarist. And in using the term militarist, I'm not using it in a pejorative sense. I'm using it merely to describe someone who finds the use of military force acceptable in a certain situation. But it's absolutely critical to note, you can't be both. You can change back and forth through time, as the prophet Mormon evidently did. But at any one point, you're one or the other. Now, this principle of mutually exclusive forms of righteousness gives us a route through which we can assess the necessary level of diversity within the church. And the route will take us through the 13th article of faith, which reads in part, "If there is anything lovely, virtuous, or of good report or praiseworthy, we seek after these things." Well, I take that to mean that if there is any good anywhere, then it is acceptable to the church, and the church is better for having it. But because I also believe in mutually exclusive forms of righteousness, that means that we have to have a diversity of membership to cover all those forms of good. Let me explain that in slightly different terms. A conscientious objector, no matter how well-intentioned, is not out physically defending the oppressed against an armed aggressor. And a militarist has never renounced war, which is really is the key to long-term survival of our species. Both of these things are good. No single person can incorporate both simultaneously. Only together do they cover all the moral responses to the crime that is war. This principle of mutually exclusive forms of righteousness may be extended to other moral issues. We've talked a little bit about abortion today. Surely there are thoughtful, moral, committed people on both sides of this equation. And though the images of pro-choice activists bailing out Operation Rescue personnel after an illegal demonstration, or of pro-life activists giving unqualified aid and supports to a teenage girl going into an abortion might strike us as utterly bizarre, they might just be what the example of the support that Captain Moroni and the people of Ammon extended to each other demands of us. It's not that we have to renounce our beliefs, but we do have a religious obligation to find all that is good and support it. My hope is that we will be bright enough to someday recognize the issues for which there are mutually exclusive forms of righteousness, that we will endeavor to take full advantage of the diversity offered by those issues, and that we will support that diversity in a way that would make both the people of Ammon and Captain Moroni proud. Thank you.
My creed statement is to have a title. I suppose it could be From the Gospel of Mark to Ecclesiastes and Points in Between, or subtitled If Faith Precedes the Miracle, What Then Follows It? As some of you know, I went through the ordeal of a lifetime a few years ago. Almost exactly 3 years ago, I was diagnosed with an acute and deadly form of leukemia. Against the odds, and through Herculean personal and medical efforts over a 5-month period, and through an outpouring of love, support, fasting, and prayer from my family, even my then 3-year-old daughter, my friends, and our household of faith, which included many of you, I am cured. That experience, its trauma and its beauty, is core to how my faith is structured, and to how I will be for and how I will forever acknowledge the hand of God in my life. Yet really, the kind of faith that has followed my miracle is much in line with the kind of faith that had been preceding it, at least for a decade or more. It is a different kind of faith from the certain testimony I once had, and it is different now, even after the certainty of the miracle I experienced. A couple of years ago in a Relief Society lesson, we broke into small discussion groups to discuss, as I recall, aspects of our testimony or faith that have sustained us in our lives. This incident occurred within about 8 months of my bone marrow transplant, a time when I knew, in the most visceral way, that the hand of God had intervened to save my life. Yet when my turn came in the group, I was astonished by what came out of my mouth, as I and others often are. What I said was that I believed God had blessed me, in the here and now, by taking away, for a time, the immediacy of what had always been a mainstay of my faith. I have always had strong faith and a very certain comfort in the reality of the resurrection of Jesus. I always have had a fundamental belief in the eternality of this life and looked upon death as a door or window, a part of this life that we all pass through in the continuation of our eternal lives. But after my miracle, something shifted for a while. Sitting in that Relief Society class, I knew that my faith in the next life had been taken from me for a time, just as it had been given, and that it had been replaced by a different gift, the gift of being able to secure myself here in this world on solid ground with no reality of any other time or any other place. Interestingly, now, as even more time has passed, I find myself reaccessing that gift of faith in the eternality of my life. But how often do we look for the grace or the gift that our doubts, our disbelief may be? A year ago on Palm Sunday and the first day of Passover, I gave a talk in my ward. It was essentially my own personal Passover sermon, the story of my own saving event, which I felt honored to tell and remember publicly as my offering to the household of faith. I had a text for that talk. It was the 114th Psalm, with its wonderful images of the sea fleeing, Jordan turning backward, mountains skipping like rams, and the turning of hard rock into living water. I witnessed to this time in my life when a rampaging illness was miraculously turned back against its course. And when when those who were with me experienced an outpouring of spiritual gifts. It was a time indeed when our community of faith was, as Paul describes, the body of Christ and members in particular, each expressing a particular gift. I spoke of the manifestation of those gifts, powerful priesthood blessings from Dick Paul Freeman and Steve Rowland, and I might add as an aside, the ministering of particularly Dick and others who were often available to me daily if I needed him or them. I spoke of friends who seemed blessed with the inspiration to say exactly what was needed, when it was needed. There were gifts of prophecy and wisdom, times when I knew exactly what to do, what course to follow in my treatment program. There was the gift of revelation when two people close to me were given spiritual knowledge that I would be healed. I experienced the gift of believing on their words. And, of course, there was the gift of healing itself. I spoke about how during my long hospitalization, I craved the Gospel of Mark. I read it. I had friends read sections to me. I loved it for its compressed style and tone, for the immediacy of its message. Healing runs through this Gospel as a leitmotif, and the miracles of Jesus are told in crescendo, dramatically, one on top of the other with little commentary. I loved the words of the father of the possessed child who cried to Jesus, "Lord, I believe, help thou mine unbelief." But now, I don't know that this is the speech I would give at this point in time. I don't often have a very ready access to the transcendent these days, and friends who are blessed with the perfect words to say now can sometimes say precisely the wrong thing. My saving event is forever a part of my soul and my faith, but there is no doubt that reality is back. Or, as Marilyn Thompson put it so well, you got your life back. It was what you wanted. I am much more drawn to the voice of Joseph Smith, who recognized that there must needs be opposition in all things, than I am to the voice who viewed perfecting the saints as a primary obligation of the church. I have come to believe that becoming more fully human is more desirable and even more holy than is the striving to become perfect. And I have to say that even having looked death in the face, the idea of personal exaltation or making it to the celestial kingdom is not at all relevant to me. In the race for that great Mormon Wimbledon in the sky, I'm out of the running. I believe that it is wonderful to be alive in this world, which so embodies this rule of opposition. I treasure my hours to wake and to sleep, to perceive light and darkness, to feel joy and grief, to experience unbounded love, and to learn from human conflict. I love the expansiveness of vision in that particular element of Mormonism that I treasure, that wholeness of view that somehow allows for a limited yet omnipotent deity, that contains at once the reality of the randomness